welcome to Worlds Apart. Global politics has never been particularly orderly or predictable, but the recent American elections and their aftermath are likely to add even more frenzy to the already boiling geopolitical cauldron. As the United States gears up for another 4 years of depolarization at home, can the rest of the world draw closer, if nothing else than to protect itself from the outbursts of the aging hegemon? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Arvind Gupta, director of the Vivekananda International Foundation in New Delhi. Mr. Gupta, it's great to see you again. Thank you very much for your time. Now, you wrote recently that the countries of the world, and particularly our continent of Eurasia, have to prepare themselves for a flurry of black swan events in the coming months. Given that we are recording this interview on the first morning after the American elections, with Donald Trump already being announced as the 47th president of the United States, do you think one of those big dark birds has already landed?
Yes, I think the world situation is changing very fast, and we'll have a new administration. And as you said, the country is polarized. So we expect some major changes in the U.S. administration's policies. There are two major wars which are going on in the world. We'll have to see how the Trump administration would react to that. Then, of course, there are major problems in the world in terms of climate change, for instance. Trump earlier was not in favor of Paris agreements, etc. And we are going to have a COP29 within a few days in Baku. Major decisions are expected there. So the American position will be very important in the context of climate change. Then, of course, the entire world, we are seeing the global economic situation is also very precarious. Several sanctions have been imposed. Sanctions have been weaponized. The international financial system has been weaponized. And this has created huge turbulence in the world in the past. And that leads to further instabilities. So we'll have to see how the new administration reacts to that. The multilateralism also is in limbo right now. It's in, I'm talking of the UN system, whether there would be some attempt to restore that. So as you said, aging hegemon, they have some responsibility to keep bringing some order to the world.
Well, they claim that responsibility, or rather they claim that power status, but I'm not sure they're putting a lot of effort into that. And yet, I also want to ask you about India's specific position, because I heard some of your Indian colleagues say that India is one of the very few countries in the world that doesn't really care whether it's Kamala Harris or Donald Trump who moves into the White House, because New Delhi will continue having a more or less cooperative relationship with Washington. But I wonder if the U.S., the more hostile U.S. policy vis-a-vis other countries would still affect India, albeit indirectly.
I think the assessment is based on the fact that over the last 20 years, there have been different administrations in the U.S. And by and large, the trajectory of Indo-U.S. relationship has been upward. So it's in that context that people are saying that perhaps there is a fairly deep relationship between India and the U.S., so that might continue. But nevertheless, the specific issues on how they react, etc., these are very important and we'll have to see. So one cannot be too sanguine as to in what way a particular relationship moves. But yes, there is a foundation. And our experience of the last administration dealing with Trump was good. It was not bad. So we'll have to see how Trump 2.0 shapes up.
I think what's special about India is that it has been able, one of the very few countries that has been able to benefit from the animosity between Russia and the West, both economically in terms of lower energy prices and also politically, because I think both Russia and the West are still, you know, seeking a good relationship with your country, and that allows you more visibility and more influence on the international stage. Do you think that's a special case, or do you think India has indeed invented some sort of a recipe of turning geopolitical lemons into the lemonade?
No, I don't think there's anything very special in our functioning. It's simply because India has grown. India has a geopolitical location, which is very important. But most important, I think it is the growth of the Indian economy. Today, it is the fifth largest economy in the world. And very soon, I think within a few months, perhaps, it will be the third largest economy in the world. Plus the fact that the Indian policy has been, dictated by a friendship to all. Vasudev Kutumbakam, for instance, was the key theme of the overarching theme of G20, which means the world is one, and India does believe in that. So Indian position has been that of engagement, particularly in the last 10 years or so. Our engagements with all parts of the world, with all countries, have increased. And more important, I think India has today something to contribute. It's not simply a taker. It is by way of its developmental experience, by way of its achievements in the, let's say, in the digital space. Today, India is able, is in a position to share a lot with the world. And during, for instance, the COVID pandemic, when the Western countries and the developed countries were hoarding vaccines, India was sharing vaccines at that point of time. So India, by its actions, by enhanced engagements, I think has kind of shown that engagement with India is not only good for us, but also good for the world.
Let me bring in one more actor, which is China, because over the last couple of months, we've seen some normalization steps between New Delhi and Beijing. The officials said that 75% of the outstanding border issues have been resolved. Do you think the impetus to solve the remaining problems is higher or lower now that Trump is in office? And what could the sort of more harmonious relationship between China and India mean for the region and for the world at large?
No, in India, we have welcomed this the border agreement, but I must say that this is of a limited nature. The India-China border issue is very complex. It is still unresolved. This related to only very small part of the border and related to some incident which took place on the border in 2020. And there were a few what they call the friction points, and now we have resolved, and the patrolling had stopped, and there was some agreement between India and China going back to mid-90s. That was kind of violated. Now I think we are restoring that, and some kind of a normal patrolling would begin. So it really refers to that. But the larger issue of India-China border is still unsettled. But we hope that this reduction in tension between India and China would benefit both India and China as well as the region.
Who is more interested in the normalization of ties right now? The reason I'm asking is because I have a sort of cynical thought at the back of my mind that the Chinese may be moving towards the reconciliation with India because they predict or they forecast growing problems with the Trump administration.
Well, you see, India and China, even before 2020, we had some very good meetings and discussions at the informal summits. Two informal summits were held. So both sides were interested in improving their relationship. And now, 2020 disrupted that. And I think probably we'll come back to that situation where India and China would like to improve their relationship. But having said that, I must also add here that though we had this border problem, but India-China trade was increasing. And we had reached, I think, something like $115 billion. But the trade was one-sided. I mean, we had a trade imbalance of something like about $80 billion, which was very highly unsustainable. Now, whether these developments of the recent past or recent weeks would lead to redressing some of these issues, which are long-term and which are structural issues in India-China relations, that we will have to see.
Now, if we look at other countries in Asia, in India's proximity, there's still a lot of instability. Bangladesh has just gone through a major political collapse. Sri Lanka is experiencing a major economic crisis. Myanmar is not stable. And I've heard you say that people who were watching, who are watching geopolitical trends were not able to predict any of those developments. What do you think is happening in Asia with so many disturbances on the social or state level?
It's a very complex region, and many of these countries over the last few years, I think they have got into some difficult economic situation. Their balances have changed. For instance, in the case of Sri Lanka, it accumulated so much debt that it could not repay. And it accumulated so much debt simply because its internal economic situation was not good. There was hardly any production. They were depending only on some tourism, etc. Then there was also, I think, the geopolitical situation. The integration in South Asia, the regional integration, economic integration in South Asia has not really taken place. And there were many reasons for that. India, though it's a very big economy, it normally should have very close economic relationship with the neighboring countries. But most of these countries were trading with outside world. And that, that means they had to forego some of the advantages, and which really reflected in their internal economic developments. Then, of course, the geopolitics also meant the China's rise, the way it has impacted the region. And many of these countries, they want to keep their options between India and China open, etc. So that created some problems. And that also, I think, inhibited close economic ties between India and these countries. With Bangladesh, we had, of course, a very good relationship in the last 15 years. India-Bangladesh relationship developed. But all that has now changed. And I think we'll have to see how India-Bangladesh relationship progresses. Because in the last 15 years, we did build a lot of connectivity, which was very important for both India and Bangladesh. But now, again, we're in a new situation. Now, with the coming of Trump, new administration, we'll have to see how their policy towards South Asia develops. Because in the last administration, they were very unhappy with the Sheikh Hasina government. And probably that also was one of the reasons for how the developments in Bangladesh took place. So it's a very fluid situation, and it's uncertain situation. And perhaps one of those black swans,
Well, not one, but there seems to be quite a few of them.
Yes, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka was certainly black swans. Nobody really saw it coming until it happened.
Do you expect more countries to exhibit the problems of a
similar
kind?
If you look at the socio-economic situation in our neighborhood, many of these countries are experiencing problems. We are seeing Pakistan also under huge debt, also geopolitics. We are seeing Afghanistan, Sri Lanka and Bangladesh, you mentioned. Maldives is another example. Maldives, during the presidential election, they took some views of India out, so-called. But then they started experiencing some internal economic development. And I'm glad that President Muizu visited India, and now I think the relationship is coming back on track. So there is a lot of thinking that our countries and our neighborhood will be doing when the Trump administration comes. So how they develop their relations with China, with the US, with India. So for them also, it's a complicated situation.
Well, Mr. Gupta, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Claimed and ruined the lives of tens of thousands, but it was the Hague Tribunal that dealt the finishing blow to the Serbs.
Masovnih stradanja u Sarajevu, to ćemo ovdje dokazati.
I ništa mi ne možete. Da Srbi ostanu osamoćeni u planetarnim razmerama. Ja sam ih do kraja ponizio, bacio sam ih u blato, rasturio, pokazao da to nije nikakav sud.
Taj rad tribunala je, kažem, bio otrovan tim što su sve sudije već došle sa predubeđenjem. Šta se zaista desilo u Bosni i Hercegovini i šta se zaista desilo? Dakle, oni nisu provodili pravdu, oslanjali su se samo na zapadni narativ.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Arvind Gupta, director of the Vivekananda International Foundation in New Delhi. Mr. Gupta, before the break, we were talking about so many Black Swan events in your and our neighborhood. And I want to ask you a sort of general philosophical question, because stability is not a very popular term in geopolitical circles these days. Countries tend to speak more about resilience, but ultimately it conveys a similar ability, the ability to withstand and effectively deal with multiple old and new challenges, as well as to, counter sometimes malicious interference from unfriendly places. What does it take in this day and age for a country to maintain and foster its own resilience?
I think one is that as we were hearing recently, just a few moments ago, from your Deputy Prime Minister also, that we need to build our internal strengths. We should also focus on our human resources, which means through education, through skilling, etc. This is a world of technology, and a certain technological sovereignty is also very important. What has happened is that in this world of globalization, very often we trade without our knowing sometimes our sovereignty. I think it's very necessary that the countries should retain a certain strengths which help them to protect their sovereignties in different areas, technology, economy, etc. Once you do that, then perhaps the engagement with the rest of the world is important. Every country has some kind of a strength. Somebody is good in agriculture, somebody is good in something else. And certainly larger countries like India, we have multiple strengths. So it's very important that we should be aware of this. And I think in the case of India, I can also say that India is a young nation, only 77 years old, but a very old and a rich civilization. Going back to some of our civilizational attributes, trying to look for ideas which have sustained us for thousands of years, are some of them valid today? And very important to keep our societies together, I think.
Well, let me ask you specifically about that, because India also is the world's most populous democracy. And I want to ask you specifically about the relationship between democratic politics and political instability, because what we saw in the run-up to the American elections, for example, two assassination attempts on a presidential candidate, depolarization, hatred, almost hatred between various sectors of society, people stocking up on arms, all of that is ultimately a consequence of politicians allowing themselves to use extreme emotions like hatred, anger, fear, scorn, shame, in order to advance their political goals. But, there are deep consequences for the society when you do that. Do you think part of that instability that we have been discussing and this descent of black swans may be related to the way democratic politics has been practiced, not necessarily in India, but more broadly around the world? Because this type of campaigning, high pitch, very emotional campaigning, seem to be like something to emulate. That's part of the democratic practice these days.
You see, democracy, in the end, it should be about accommodating an other's a different viewpoint. It's so very important. So, in the earlier form of democracy, a country, a party would win, And there would be an opposition party, but there would be some dialogue between the...
There were some limits on what was considered acceptable and respectable, I suppose.
So I think respecting the other viewpoint is perhaps the fundamental tenet of democratic functioning. Somehow that has is not happening, and we're seeing it not just in America, but in so many other countries. Political violence is something that is needs to be eschewed, and this is a time to think that this is not democracy. Political violence is not democracy. So I think the older values of tolerance, accommodation, going back to the basics of family, how are we caring and sharing, that doesn't mean that you leave or jettison your own way of thinking, but that only means that you also give some respect to the other viewpoint. And I think this is what has to come in our politics also, both domestic national politics, but also in international politics. And that's why I think the popularity of the ideas like BRICS, where a diverse set of countries is coming together, and they're all being hopefully being treated equally with respect, etc., and trying to work together. We may not find the solutions of every single problem. Some problems are so difficult that the solutions are not very easy. But if you have this attitude of respecting diversity, so respecting diversity should become a stated and obvious and apparent goal of democratic functioning. But that is not happening. Now it is intolerance, democracy and intolerance, which is really an oxymoron. Shouldn't happen that way, but that's...
It's not genuine democracy then. The reason I'm asking is because I've been thinking about whether those labels of democracy versus autocracy will be relevant in the coming years, because when we look at let's say, China and India competing for the leadership of the global south, I don't think, you know, other countries are really making their decisions based on how India or China are structured internally, but rather on what those countries can offer to, you know, the third party partners, to the developing world.
Absolutely. I think that's how it should be. Internal developments we should leave to the those countries, and it's really how we interact with each other and how we contribute to common good and how do we resolve our problems. That's how I think it should run. Democracy, you see, what happens is that anything, when it becomes an ideology, it becomes a problem. There is a difference between philosophy and ideology. In philosophy, we say that, okay, what's your view? This is my view. Let's have a discussion and let's agree to disagree. But in ideology, this is your view, this is my view, but my view is superior. And that's where the problems start.
Now, speaking about India and China, both these countries have outreach policies that stress the relatedness of all humanity. The Indian version is called, I hope I pronounce it correctly, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, while the Chinese talk about a community of common destiny. It sounds very similar, but I'm sure there must be some cultural differences. How do you understand those differences?
Well, as far as Vasudeva Kutumbakam is concerned, it's an ancient Indian philosophy coming from Mahaupanishad. As you know, there are the in ancient Indian thinking, there are these philosophical discourses called Upanishads. There are 18 of them. So it's one of them. And it basically says that it comes from a verse which basically says that those who do not believe that world is a family and believe that they are in the other, they are, I think, wrong. So this is basically what Vasudeva Kutumbakam means. That means you should treat the world as a family. In shared community, and which is the Chinese thinking, etc., yes, I think apparently they are similar. But so long as we'll have to see the politics behind this. So that's, I think, there could be some differences. But there is no harm in talking about these and trying to find out what exactly mean. In fact, I want to mention one more concept, which I learned only recently. And this is called Ubuntu. Ubuntu comes from the South African thing, and which means interconnectedness of the world, and which is very similar to the Vasudeva Kutumbakam that we are talking about. So long as believe in interconnectedness in the world and also accommodating others' ideas, So if I say that Vasudev Kutumbakam, but it is my idea, then it doesn't work. So I think...
Well, you have to not only preach, but also practice.
Yes,
I suppose
absolutely.
That's what you say. Now, both China and India have expressed a willingness to mediate the conflict in Ukraine. Do you think that's just a publicity stunt, or do you think there is some substance to it? Can one or perhaps both of them meaningfully contribute to some sort of a lasting settlement between Russia, Ukraine, and hopefully the West as well?
I think what it shows is that the world at large wants this conflict to be settled. If maybe there is a ceasefire or something, you know, because...
Well, I'm not sure Russia is interested in a ceasefire.
Yeah, I think this is the point. The point is that none of this will work unless the both sides are...
Or three sides, rather.
Or maybe more sides. Here, I think the issue is that the war is going on, and there is a certain military dynamic to that. And I'm sure those who are involved, they would have to take note of that. So the rest of the world, because of the collateral damage or the consequences that the rest of the world is suffering, so they would like a peace to come in. But it is really when the both sides are necessary, then they can talk to each other. I don't think they really need any mediators. I personally feel that there is enough experience in Russia or Ukraine or Russia and the West, etc., who have been involved in so many other issues. If once they are ready, they can probably talk. So it's okay. I mean, I think it's only in some way the rest of the world is conveying to the parties involved in the war that there could be some settlement and that we should settle.
And finally, if I may ask you, you recently wrote an article on the changing nature of warfare, and you make a point there that the long wars have returned and that they require significant efforts or ultimately the restructuring of the economy to ensure the availability of ammunition, war wastage reserves, logistics, etc. I wonder if India, which has a reputation or at least some historical connection to the pacifism, do you think your country will be more likely to invest in these drawn-out wars, or is it more likely to invest in the efforts to prevent them?
No, I think India has to look at its own security environment. And when we wrote that article, we were trying to study the Russia-Ukraine war and the lessons for the security community and for us. So it was in that context that I wrote that article. India, see, just talk pacifism alone will not take you very far. There is something called a deterrence, and which will have to be built. And a big country like India, or for that matter China or anybody else, they work on the deterrence. So deterrence, the hard power, is equally important. But hard power combined with the soft power, which is about peace, etc., Vasudev Kutumbakam, world is one family, etc., there's no contradiction here. So I think India will have to build its capabilities, because we have seen when we did not have the capabilities, we suffered.
So in other words, if you want a peace, prepare for war.
Not prepare for war, but deter war.
Well, Mr. Gupta, it's been great talking to you
again.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.